Yeah, so thanks to the organisers for inviting me. So this is based on two papers, which were joint work with Benjamin Mustin and David Voiter, both at Oxford. A compositional theory of quantum functions and the Morita theory of quantum graph isomorphisms. So, I mean, is this work really foundations? Well, maybe not explicitly, but it does have maybe some foundational interest. So it introduces new mathematical tools that may be of interest. While these mathematical tools have appeared before, like theory of semi-simple categories in quantum matter, etc., it's unusual that they should appear together in this particular area. So it's a connection between quantization and categorification, which has been talked about before, but here it becomes very explicit. New constructions of contextuality based on non-abelian group symmetry. And it also clarifies compositional aspects of quantum functions. So to explain this last point, I'll probably say what I mean by quantum function. A good place to start. Yes. So what is a quantum function? Well, a function you can think of as taking in some element of an input set, giving out some element of an output set. So it takes in some x, this is some y in a deterministic manner. A stochastic function you can think of as using some observation, some classical randomness to do the same task. So you get some x, you use some underlying probability distribution to figure out which y you give out. A quantum function, by analogy, takes in some x and uses an observation, a measurement on an underlying Hilbert space to figure out which element of the output set to give. And we've seen these already. I don't know if this example, another example is going to be there. So we've seen these already, for instance, in the Bell test scenario, quantum correlations. Alice and Bob are both performing quantum functions. They get some measurement settings, they perform their measurement, and then they give an output back. So we've seen a few of these this week. So the idea is to take this analogy with functions and basically develop it. There's a problem, initial problem, which is that the sets and Hilbert spaces, they live in a different category. So we need some way to put them on the same footing. So to do this, we'll use Gelfand duality. This allows us to kind of embed the theory of sets and functions in Hilbert spaces and linear maps. The usual formulation of Gelfand duality is, in the finite set case, which is particularly simple, you've got some finite set. But then you can consider the algebra of functions from the finite set to the complex numbers. This is a commutative C-star algebra. And functions between finite sets are going to go to homomorphisms between the C-star algebras. So there's a duality there. And by analogy, you could say that the non-commutative C-star algebras correspond to finite quantum sets. In the general setting, what these are is quite nebulous, but there have been ideas about what quantum sets could be. There's work of Cornell recently. So maybe these aren't so nebulous. But here we just talk about the C-star algebras. So we've got an initial quantum set. But for finite sets, we can formulate all this using Frobenius algebras. We don't need to use the language of C-star algebras, although it's exactly the same thing. So let's do that now. Gelfand duality in diagrams. You can think of the way to get from sets to algebras is the following. You take a set X, and you can identify the set with an orthonormal basis of some vector space, of the dimension of the cardinality of the set. And the algebra structure is going to compare the basis elements. So I'll draw these diagrams fairly often. This is just a diagram. They should be read from bottom to top. This is the vector space here, and this is a linear map which takes two copies of the vector space to one copy of the vector space. And this is the explicit description of that linear map. You see, if you put a basis element I in there and a basis element j in there, it's going to give you the basis element if it's the same and nothing if they're different. So that's the description of that diagram there. And the unit is just going to produce a superposition over all the basis elements. So we've identified sets with these algebras. And if you take the adjoints of these as well, the maps are going to give you the structure of a commutative special dagger Frobenius algebra on this vector space. That's just one of these. So here are the maps, here are the adjoints. They need to obey these equations, associativity, co-associativity, Frobenius, speciality, and commutativity. So these are precisely commutative C-star algebras. These things in Hilbert are precisely commutative C-star algebras. So it's the same deal. But going back from algebras to sets, you can cover the element of the set as the copyable states of the algebra. So these are maps from the complex numbers into the algebra, which satisfy these equations here. And functions, you expect these to be linear maps that map elements to elements of the sets. They correspond to star cohomomorphisms between the algebras, which are just these equations here. So we've got this duality. Well, actually, it's an equivalence now because we're using cohomomorphisms. We've got this equivalence between from sets and functions to the commutative Frobenius algebras and star cohomomorphisms in Hilbert. And you can generalize to quantum sets by moving from commutative to symmetric, so you weaken the commutativity condition. And this is the same as moving from commutative C-star algebras to non-commutative C-star algebras. So this is just something we can do in finite dimensions. What's nice about it, it makes certain structures in the C-star algebra clear that weren't clear before, like the co-multiplication. So that's great. So we've got quantum sets, and we've got ordinary functions between quantum sets. But what are quantum functions between quantum sets? So we'll start with quantum elements. So we saw before how elements of the set correspond to these copyable states in the algebra. We'll use that intuition we had before about a quantum function as something that uses an underlying Hilbert space to obtain an element. And we'll just quantize this by taking it as a map from now that a Hilbert space. It uses the Hilbert space to produce an element. It obeys the same equations. You essentially stick a wire through these equations. So this is a definition here. But what is a quantum element? So what is something satisfying these equations? Well, for classical sets, they're just projective measurements with outcomes in the set X. Why is that? Well, you consider I haven't drawn this, but maybe I should draw it. You consider the map. You consider the what the map on the Hilbert space is when the output I appears. So you consider. You put the effect corresponding to that element of the. So this thing here has some basis corresponding to elements of the set, and you consider what this is. So this is the what happens to the Hilbert space when you get the element I. And then this here is going to you put an I there and an I there. This gives you kind of an I there and a J there. That gives you delta of IJ. So delta of IJ times. So essentially, this is going to give you orthogonality when these are different because of this co-multiplication there. And it's going to give you idempotency when they're the same. We'll see this more clearly in a minute because we'll see it for quantum functions too. So basically, these just tell you that these things are orthogonal projectors they're orthogonal projectors and they're complete and they're Hermitian. Okay, so what are they more generally? So we've figured out their projective measurements for quantum sets. For classical sets, what are they more generally? More generally, they're just co-modules of the algebra. So these are the co-module equations. So they form a category. They have intertwiners. So you can consider linear maps on the Hilbert space wire, which intertwine with the elements. So this you can consider this as some morphism from this quantum element to this quantum element. And so what we had was just a set of classical elements before has now become a category of quantum elements. objects are quantum elements, and morphisms are these intertwiners. And the classical elements are going to live in this category still as the one-dimensional quantum elements, where this Hilbert space is just one-dimensional. And as you can recover classical sets and quantum sets, you can recover the quantum set from its category of quantum elements and the forgetful functor, which just considers this as just being a linear map. So that's your quantum elements. Okay, what about quantum functions then? we had this identification of these with functions. Now we do the same trick. We define a quantum function as being a kind of using a Hilbert space to perform this, but it obeys the same equations. And these are again going to form a category with intertwiners as morphisms. You can define intertwiners in the same way as linear maps, which take one quantum function to another quantum function. And what are classical functions between quantum between classical? What are quantum functions between classical sets? They're just going to be controlled projective measurements. So here we see it again with the equation here. This is the thing I was talking about with the element. So this is the, you can say this is the map which takes in an element of the set X, and this is the map which takes in an element of the set X, gives you an element of the set Y. And here you see that this first equation, it's going to give you if you consider what gives you X, Y dash Y, this is going to just compare these, and it'll give you delta Y, Y, and on this side you get two of them. So this is idempotency. And if they're different, then it's if the y dash and y are different, then it's going to be zero. And if the y dash and the y are the same, then it's going to be just one of them. So you get idempotency in that case, and orthogonality in the other case. Right. So what's a quantum function? So you can express these as matrices of projectors, where the rows with orthogonality and completeness along rows and columns. So each row corresponds to a projective measurement. So the row corresponds to the input X here, and the column corresponds to the output Y. And composition then is this normal matrix multiplication. You stick these together. So what's a quantum function between a quantum set? So quantum function between classical sets are controlled projective measurements, or a quantum function between quantum sets? Well, in general, the star cohomomorphisms, the star cohomomorphisms between these things are a set of functions between the quantum sets. We want a quantum set of quantum functions. So you define the idea is to define and use the internal HOM in the category. C star out is the function algebra. C star out drop is meant to be the quantum spaces that are dual to the function algebra. So you use the internal HOM in the category C star R drop. And the theorem is that the category of quantum functions that we just defined is the opposite of the category of representations of AB. The thing is, we can't define co-modules, co-representations, because there's no co-multiplication on the internal HOM, because it's generally dimensional. So we take the opposite of the category, and this can be considered as the generalized quantum elements. So basically, the quantum function is the quantum elements of the internal HOM. And in the case where you've got the internal HOM from the complex numbers into the algebra, you just get quantum elements back. But in general, you can't recover this from the category of quantum elements. For a start, this is only the finite dimensional quantum elements. So we define quantum elements and quantum functions using this operational principle and Gell-Fang duality. And we've shown that they form categories rather than sets. So, and concretely, the quantum function in classical sets control projective measurements. Quantum function in quantum sets are representations of the internal HOM, finite dimensional representations of the internal HOM. So now we're going to investigate the semi-simple structure of the category of quantum functions. This is going to have some more physical kind of interpretation. And we're also going to show how they fit into a two-category of quantum sets. So we had a category of sets and functions. Now we've got a two-category of quantum sets and quantum functions. After that, we're going to do something with this theory we're developing. We're going to apply it to a certain classify instances of pseudo-telepathy in a certain non-local game. So there's a Dirac sum of quantum functions. You just take the Dirac sum of the linear maps. And for a quantum function between classical sets, the Dirac sum is going to be equivalent to, it's a matrix of projectors, remember, defining a projective measurement. So for a quantum function of classical sets, you're just going to sum over the projectors individually. Operationally, you can think of this as a mixing of quantum functions. So it's a mixing of these control projective measurements. Because the operations we're following give you equivalent probabilities. You can perform the quantum measurement. You can kind of diligently perform this. Or alternatively, you can projectively measure onto this Hilbert space or this Hilbert space. And then, depending on the outcome, you just perform either this or this. So there's no, you're not using, you're using the quantum, using this, it's kind of a classical mixing, using the Hilbert space to get a classical probability distribution, which you then use to perform your function. So simple quantum functions are quantum functions that can't be decomposed in this way. You are purely, you can't measure and then receive your input. You need to wait to receive your input before measuring in order to get the same probabilities. And for classical sets, this is equivalent here. That the intertwiners are all scalar multiples of the identity. And for classical sets, this is just going to reduce to if you find something commuting with all the projectors in your matrix of projectors, it's going to be a scalar multiple of the identity. And the theorem is this: every quantum function in QSET AB can be decomposed as a finite direct sum of these things. So there could be infinitely many simple quantum functions, but any quantum function you have can be decomposed as a finite direct sum of these things. So you can break it down into these simple indecomposable quantum functions. And that completely characterizes the intertwiners in this category. In general, there are infinitely many simple quantum functions. But this allows us to kind of derive a notion of classicality for these quantum functions, these control projective measurements. We say they're essentially classical if they're a direct sum of a quantum function in classical sets. We say it's essentially classical if it's a direct sum of classical functions as one-dimensional functions. And that's equivalent to all the projectors commuting. So the Hilbert space is just being used to generate classical randomness. You might as well do your measurements on the Hilbert space and then receive you, and then you get a probability distribution, and then you use that to perform, to get your output, your input. So a projective measurement, for instance, is like this, because, so that might seem slightly surprising, but I suppose you can think of it as there's no, there's no input. So you might as well measure before and then get your output. There's no input there. So this is more kind of to do with contextuality, I suppose. Depending on what input you get in, you need to use the Hilbert space. So here's another example. This can be decomposed. So you decompose the Hilbert space like this, and then it becomes a sum of permutations. This can't be decomposed. You can find out there's nothing that commutes with local projectors that's not a scalar multiple of the identity. It's four-dimensional and simple. Great, so that's the structure of these categories. So we now understand what these categories of quantum functions look like. So now we want to understand the kind of more global structure of quantum sets and quantum functions. So we want to understand how quantum functions compose. And so this uses a two-category. A two-category is just something where you've got morphisms between morphisms. So now we've got quantum sets, we've got quantum functions, but we've also got functions between functions, if you like. That's all there is to it, really. This is the composition of quantum functions. They compose to give you a quantum function with the tensor product Hilbert space. And there's two ways to compose two morphisms. If you have two morphisms on this Y, you can compose them that way. Two morphisms from Q to Q dash, two morphisms from P to P dash, you can take the tensor product. So that's all there is to this two category. But when you know it's a two category, you can do lots of interesting things with it. So you might ask what the quantization of a bijection is, for instance. So this would be something invertible. So there's several ways to arrive at the concept of the question of a bijection. You can formulate a bijection classically as being a star cohomomorphism which satisfies these additional equations here, which are kind of the flips of the star cohomomorphism equations. And you can add a Hilbert space wire, you can add the Hilbert space wire to get the quantum function, but you can also do these equations too. You can quantize these equations too. So this is some notion of a quantum bijection. But we want to know in what sense this is invertible. So actually, in two categories, there's two notions of invertibility. Firstly, there's equivalence. So this is the strong notion of invertibility in the two categories. So in these diagrams should be read as these regions are objects, and the lines, the one-dimensional lines are one morphisms, and the nodes are two morphisms. So what this is doing here, this is the object A, blue, red is B, and this is the function F from, you should read from left to right, this is the function F from A to B, this is the function G from B to A, and what this is doing is it's a two morphism, it's going from G after F to the identity. So that's how you should read these diagrams here. And so one morphism is an equivalence. If you've got this going from G to composer left to the identity, this going the other way, this going from F composer D to the identity, this going the other way, such that they're inverses. So if you do this after this, it's the same as doing nothing at all. If you do this after this, it's the same as doing nothing at all. So that's an equivalence. And if you spell out what this is in QSET, it's just the one-dimensional. They're all one-dimensional. They start isomorphism, so it's too strong for that notion of quantum bijection. So why is this? I mean, forget this long proof here. Basically, these things are linear maps. The two morphisms are linear maps, and they need to be invertible for this to be an equivalence. So it's going to take you from the composition of your quantum bijection with its inverse to nothing at all. But nothing at all has an underlying one-dimensional Hilbert space, and this has an underlying HG times HF dimensional Hilbert space. And so these must have been one-dimensional functions to begin with, just because you need an isomorphism from this, from the underlying Hilbert space of this, the underlying Hilbert space of that. So it's too strong a notion, basically. So we need a weaker notion. And there's a weaker notion of invertibility in the two categories, which is a dualizable morphism. You have the same thing you had before, but now rather than obeying those invertibility equations, they obey these snake equations. This is extremely natural in category theory. There are only two notions of invertibility in two category theory, and this is the other one. So what's this? Well, the theorem is that the quantum bijections are precisely these, up to some kind of compatibility with the Hermitian adjoint structure. This is your dual here. And these are the equations that the morphism and its dual obey. So to interpret these kind of operationally, I suppose this is the entangled state, and this is the Bell state, and this is the effect corresponding to the Bell state. So in a sense, if you do the quantum function corresponding to P and the quantum function corresponding to P dual, then if you keep track of the Hilbert spaces and you do some kind of post-selection on the effect, you might be able to pull it back through. But operationally, this is just a kind of mathematically extremely natural definition that happens to capture what these quantum bijections are. Between classical sets, they're going to be, firstly, they only exist if the cardinalities are the same. But now we get these equations which say that the columns can meet as well. So these are those projective matrices of square matrices of projectors where the rows and columns, rows and columns are orthogonal complete. So these are called magic unitaries or projective permutation matrices. And these have appeared before. There's this notion of a quantum permutation group. So what's the quantum group of permutations, quantum permutations of a finite set? So Wang used some kind of universal construction to obtain this thing, but he also gave it in generators and relations. This just says that these are projectors, and the along rows and columns, they're partitions of unity. And it follows that they're orthogonal, and so these are the representations of this universal C-star algebra are finite dimensional representations, are these magic unitaries. So what these quantum bijections are quantum permutations in this compact group sense. And so we can use some facts about quantum bijections to understand these matrices of projectors. So here are some nice facts. They're all essentially classical if n is less than or equal to 3. And any quantum bijection between four element sets has dimension 1, 2, or 4. Right, so that's a theory. I've presented you with some kind of large theory of quantum sets, quantum functions, etc. And now we're going to use this to do something useful, which is to classify quantum pseudo-telepathy in a certain non-local game. So here's the non-local game. Quantum graph homomorphisms. So it's the Bell scenario, as usual. You've got Alice here and Bob there, and they're space-like separated. But now, rather than consider the correlations, you consider the supports. The game is defined by the supports of the correlations. So the game is defined by two graphs, gamma and gamma dash, and gamma prime. And the game is as follows. The verifier sends a vertex of the first graph to Alice, a vertex of the first graph to Bob. Both of them send back a vertex of the second graph. And the winning condition is that if the vertices of the first graph were connected, the vertices they sent back must be connected as well. And so a classical strategy for this is just a quantum, it's a classical graph homomorphism from gamma to gamma dash, because Alice just performs the graph homomorphism on the vertex she receives, Bob performs the graph homomorphism on the vertex he receives, and it's guaranteed to work because it's a graph homomorphism. But there are some graph pairs for which you can't find a classical, they're not classically homomorphic, but they are quantum homomorphic. In the sense that if you have a shared entangled state there, they can use the correlations they obtain from this entangled state to win the game. So that's the quantum graph homomorphism. Quantum graph isomorphisms are a stricter version where actually the relation between the vertices that were sent in has to be exactly the same as the relation between the vertices that are sent out. So if the vertices were unconnected, the vertices sent back have to be unconnected. If they're the same, the vertices sent back have to be the same, etc. And again, you can have pairs of graphs which there's no classical isomorphism, but there is a quantum isomorphism. And these are, we call these pseudo-telepathic, because it's like they communicated, even though they're using this to simulate communication. So we can put this within our framework. So what's a quantum graph? Well, we define a quantum graph to be this. Classically, this is just an adjacency matrix. So what this says here is if you put the basis element I in there and the basis element J in there, the I's are going to split there, so you get GIJ and GIJ, and then you get GIJ there, so it's GVW squared equals GVW. And you get the other, so this says that it's all the entries are 0 or 1, it's symmetric, and the entries along the diagonal are 1. It's probably better actually to set this equal to 0 to make contact with kind of classical graph theory, because then you don't have self-loops in your graph. But on quantum sets, these have been defined before, not in this way, obviously, but these were cover notions of other people. So symmetric quantum relations and also quantum non-computability graphs in connected to zero error communication in quantum information. So we can define graph homomorphisms as well. You define this projector here. So this takes this quantum adjacency matrix and it makes a projector out of it. And for a classical graph, this is going to project onto the subspace of edges, pairs of edges that are related by an edge. Pairs of vertices that are related by an edge. A classical graph homomorphism then is just something fulfilling this. This basically just says that if you project onto the vertices connected by an edge and then you do the homomorphism, it's the same as projecting to the vertices connected by an edge, doing the homomorphism, and then projecting onto the vertices connected by an edge in H. So vertices connected by an edge in G are sent to vertices connected by an edge. We can quantize this as before, define it like this. Quantum graph isomorphism you can define as being this and a bijection, or you can, for isomorphisms, they're just, quantum isomorphisms can be defined as, permutations that commute with the adjacency matrix. So here we can define them as quantum bijections commuting with the adjacency matrix. It amounts to the same thing. Okay, so now we can recover the notions before. So given graphs G and H, there's a perfect strategy for graph homomorphism game, if and only if there's a quantum graph homomorphism between those two graphs as defined. It's a perfect strategy for graph isomorphism game, if and only if there's a quantum graph isomorphism between those two graphs as defined. And the quantum graph isomorphisms are finite dimensional representations for quantum automorphism group algebra of a graph, which is defined in the same way Wang's thing was. So we end up with this setting where we've recovered all these notes. We can define a two-category Q graph in the same way. Objects are quantum graphs, morphisms are quantum graph homomorphisms, two morphisms are intertwiners. So we've recovered all these notions here. And what we're going to focus on now is in Q graph, we've got these dualizable morphisms from the graph to itself, which are the finite dimensional representations of Banneker's quantum automorphism group algebra. And we've got these dualizable morphisms from one graph to another graph, which are the quantum graph isomorphisms of in that non-local game. So we're going to use these to understand these. So what we're going to do is we're going to classify quantum graphs with an isomorphism to a given quantum graph based on this two-category here. And we're going to define a construction of quantum isomorphic graphs from central to isogroups of the automorphism group, the graph. We'll specialize this for classical graphs to make sure none of these are quantum. And we'll show that that some graphs can't exhibit pseudo-telepathy in the graph isomorphism game as a result of this analysis. So the idea is to relate endomorphisms of an object in the two-category, dualizable endomorphisms of an object in the two-category, to dualizable one-morphisms from an object to another object in the two-category. And this we can use a machinery that's defined in two-category theory. It's just there, we can use it, which is Morita equivalence. And this says that that dualizable one-morphisms in a like our quantum graph isomorphisms give rise to a certain algebraic structure in the category of morphisms from the object to itself. Now, how does this work? Well, you just compose the thing with its dual, and you get this endomorphism here. And then if you remember, these were dualizable, so you have these snakes. Firstly, you have these cups and caps. So you can define this as being the multiplication, in the co-multiplication, the unit, and the co-unit. And then the snake equations would apply the Frobenius laws. We can go one way. If you give me a dualizable morphism, I can give you a Frobenius algebra in the category of endomorphisms. But we can also, in a sufficiently nice two categories, we can also go the other way. We can actually take a Frobenius algebra of the right type and get a dualizable morphism out. So we take one of these nice quantum automorphisms and we get a quantum isomorphism to another graph. We want to classify quantum isomorphic graphs. So we want to know when two of these Frobenius monoids give us the same graph when we do this splitting process. So we are only interested in split Frobenius monoids, monoids that can be split to give you another graph. If the two categories are sufficiently nice, then there's a bijection between the equivalence classes of objects. There's a bijection between the isomorphism classes of graphs, which are quantum isomorphic to the original graph, and the Morita equivalence classes of special. So this is the equivalence relation that corresponds to isomorphism, corresponds to isomorphisms of your quantum isomorphic graphs. So this Morita equivalence is an invertible bimodule between if two of these Frobenius monoids have an invertible bimodule between them, then they'll give you the same graph. That's essentially all this is saying. Q graph is sufficiently nice, and this is when you can split a Frobenius monoid to get a dualizable morphism, when the underlying algebra is the isomorphic to an endomorphism algebra. And the splitting is defined by this. You can split it using this idempotent. So here's your quantum function. This normally goes up there, and this normally goes down there. So the algebra underneath is an endomorphism algebra. But now you use duality to pull this leg up, pull that leg down, and this gives you an idempotent. And if you split this, the image is going to be another vector space, and you can define a quantum graph structure on that vector space and a quantum graph isomorphism. So this gives you a constructive correspondence between the isomorphism classes quantum graphs gamma isomorphic to gamma prime isomorphic to gamma, and the Morita equivalence classes of simple Dagger-Frobenius monoids in the automorphism category. Simple Dagger-Frobenius monoids being these things. But what are these? So we want to construct quantum pseudo telepathy scenarios. I mean, what are these simple Dagger-Frobenius monoids in Q or gamma? And in general, Q or gamma is quite complicated. There's no hope of finding them. But there is a subcategory of Q or gamma that we can understand and work with. so this is just the essentially classical things in Q or gamma. It's just things that are decomposed. It's just the category generated by one-dimensional, taking direct sums of ordinary automorphisms, one-dimensional automorphisms. And this category is actually really well understood. It's isomorphic to the category of all gamma graded vector spaces. And sometimes this category is the whole of Q or gamma. So sometimes this is all there is. We say that gas has no quantum symmetries in that case. This is something that the compact quantum group people have been looking for, perhaps with no quantum symmetries. So we can use their results. Right, yeah, so what are in this classical subcategory, what are these nice simple Frobenius monoids? The definition is representation theoretic. There's a particular kind of group that has a two-co-cycle, so there's a single irreducible projective representation for this two-co-cycle. So we say that such groups are of central type. And then a nice UEB is just a unitary version of this projective representation on a vector space. So it's just unitary matrices that are a projective psi representation of this group. For such groups, you can define an analog of a kind of alternating form here, and certain subgroups are going to be marked out as co-isotropic. You can classify the simple Dagger-Frobenius monoids in Q or gamma up to Morita equivalence correspond precisely to these things here, these groups of central type. So you take your graph and your simple Dagger-Frobenius monoids. So every simple Dagger-Frobenius monoid in the classical subcategory is Morita equivalent to one of these here. You've got your subgroup L of central type. And here's your corresponding nice UEB, this unitary representation. And each of these corresponds to an element of the group. And so it's just going to be a sum over the automorphisms with this structure on the vector space part. So this is a definition, and we can work with this. So we understand what these are. So this gives us a theorem, which is if you've got a subgroup of central type, but the problem is that the graph you obtain from this might not be quantum. It might not be classical, sorry. It might be quantum. So we need some extra condition which says that the graph you obtain from splitting this thing is going to be a classical graph. And the condition is co-isotropic stabilizers. So if you take the orbits of the vertices of the graph under this under the central type subgroup of the automorphism group, you need the stabilizers of every element of the orbit to the stabilizers subgroup to be a co-isotropic group. And then you know that your new graph is going to be classical. So this gives us another classification. So first it gives us a construction. If you've got a central type subgroup, then you get a classical graph and a quantum isomorphism to the classical graph. But if it has no quantum symmetries, you know that these are all the Morita equivalence classes of simple Dagger-Frobenius monoids in your category. And then you get a bijective correspondence between these sets, so these subgroups of the automorphism group and the isomorphism classes of classical graphs. If there are quantum symmetries, it becomes much more complicated because not only might you have now simple Dagger-Frobenius algebras that aren't in this category, but some of these, there might be some bimodule in the quantum part of the category, which means that these are now Morita equivalent, these things that weren't originally Morita equivalent. So the quantum case is really hard, the classical case is much more simple. And here's an example of using the classical case at work. So here are some graphs with no quantum symmetries. These were found by Banico and Bichon in the quantum group work. So we can run through these and we can prove that none of these can admit quantum isomorphisms to another graph. And the recipe is really simple now. You just find all the central type subgroups of the automorphism group. And then you find the stabilizers of the action on the vertex set for each of these subgroups, and you show that they're not all co-isotropic. And then by these results, none of these can admit a quantum isomorphism to a non-isomorphic graph. And actually, this also classifies quantum isomorphic quantum graphs as well, because you do find central type subgroups without co-isotropic actions, but there's kind of finitely many of them. So it'd be interesting to see what it means to have a quantum isomorphism between a quantum graph and a classical graph. There is this interpretation in terms of zero quantum communication. Maybe there's something interesting there, but if there is something there, it could be classified using this technique. There's some things that weren't covered. So quantum relations, you don't have to just talk about graphs, you can talk about quantum relations. You can also reclassify the isomorphic graph scanner dash here, but you could also classify the isomorphisms themselves. You could make it a kind of stricter classification. So this is that thing I was saying about non-abelian contextuality. So there's Archipov's construction of a binary linear constraint system from a graph. So he takes a certain graph and he constructs a binary constraint system from it, and you can use a construction of Robeson and others to get a quantum graph isomorphism out of this binary constraint system. So you can go from so you can think of binary constraint systems and quantum graph isomorphism. You can word it in the language of quantum graph isomorphisms, and actually these are captured by our group theoretical construction here. These constructions here, they're all for central type subgroups Z2 to the 4 and Z2 to the 6. So that's kind of very abelian. But our construction works for other groups as well. We're still getting an example of it for other groups, but it seems that it will work. So the details of the group theoretical construction, I mean, I didn't go into I didn't talk about why we needed a co-isotropic subgroup, for instance. And I didn't really talk about the. You see, there's an interpretation of the construction in terms of induction and restriction of representations, which I didn't talk about. So the outlook is good to understand this construction in a more conceptual way. So this involves this induction and restriction of representations, which I was just mentioning. Also to use this induction restriction idea to develop kind of broader representation theoretic constructions of quantum functions. One could try to develop some physical interpretation of quantum functions between quantum sets, So quantum functions in classical sets have this interpretation of projective representations. What's a quantum function between a quantum set? I mean, we've said that it's a representation of the internal harm in the category of C-star algebras, but kind of what kind of operationally can we get out of that? Also, one could explore this quantum function theory more broadly, so that one could try and redefine, quantize new concepts in the theory of sets and functions. For instance, one could look at quantum monotone functions being quantum posets. That's kind of quantum relation. There's also kind of higher structures in QSAT and QGraph. That's all. Thank you for listening.
Can you outline, do you have any ideas to your second point? Do you have any specific ideas in that direction?
Right. Yes. Yeah, I suppose so. So, well, the basic idea is you've got a one way to get a nice what you need to define a quantum function is some kind of subspace vector, right? So you've got a subspace V11. So you're talking about matrices and projectors onto subspaces, etc. And what you really care about for your quantum function is orthogonality relations between these subspaces. So you want to know when they overlap, when they don't overlap. And one way to on all these lines you have the same underlying Hilbert space. So you've got some Hilbert space H here. Well, if you've got a big group, so if you've got G, and then G has a representation on this Hilbert space, then by restricting from G to some subgroups, H1, H2, etc., one obtains subspace. One obtains subspaces for your projectors with well understood orthogonality relations, because the relationship between irreducible representations of restricted representations is well understood in representation theory. It's this kind of Mackey's principle. You don't even have to do it. So in this case, what you wanted was a quantum graph isomorphism. So you had to have the same number of vertices. And the co-isotropy condition came from the fact that if you restricted to the stabilizer of an orbit, you needed the same number of the vertices of the new graph would correspond to these irreducible representations. And you needed the same number of irreducible representations as the number of elements in your orbit in the first place. And that's where the co-isotropy condition came from. But in general, maybe you wouldn't need the group. Maybe you could just think about representations of algebras or something like this.
This may be regarding the last point. You expect that it would be more difficult to generalize the setting.
Actually, it'll probably be for relations in general, it'll probably be easier because for a graph, if you want to use the splitting, for instance, to define a new graph, you need to say that this object has all the graph structure. And so if you remove the amount of structure that's required on the object, it's actually easier to use that kind of idea. So you could define Q rel, for instance. So all this I would imagine is kind of straightforwardly generalizable to less restrictive relations.
No more questions. Let's thank Dominic.